Why do you not worship the Greek and Roman gods? And what I'll do is, in the blue, I'll actually go through and identify where he answers the questions. And so this is chapter 2, is where he deals with that question. Let me read the text and then make a few comments about his response. Come then, clear yourself of all the bias that occupies your mind and get rid of the habit that deceives you, and become, as it were, from the beginning a new man, as one to who is to hear a new story, even as you yourself also acknowledged. See not only with your eyes, but also with your understanding, what substance or form they chance to have, whom you declare and esteem to be gods. Is not one a stone like that which we tread on, another bronze, no better than the implements which have been forged for our use, another wood already decayed, another silver which needs a man to guard it lest it be stolen, another iron eaten through by rust, another earthenware, not a whit more pleasing than that made for the meanest service. Are not all these of perishable matter? Or have they not been forged by iron and fire? Did not the sculptor fashion one of them, the brass worker another, the silversmith another, the potter another? Before they were modeled by these men's arts into the form of these gods, was not each of them subjected to transformation, and still is so even now at the hands of each artificer? Might not the vessels now formed out of the same material, if they met with the same workmen, be made similar to such images as these? Again, could not these things which are now worshipped by you become at the hands of men vessels like the rest? Are they not all dumb? Are they not blind? Are they not without souls? Are they not destitute of feeling? Are they not without motion? Are they not all rotting away? Are they not all in course of decay? These things you call gods. These are what you serve. These you worship, and in the end you become like them. For this reason you hate the Christians, because they do not think that these are gods. For is it not you who, although you consider and think that you are praising the gods, are much more despising them? Are you not much rather mocking and insulting them when you worship those of stone and earthenware which you leave unguarded, and yet those of silver and gold you lock up at night, in the daytime set guards by them, lest they be stolen? And by the honors that you think to offer them, you are punishing them rather, if indeed they are endued with sense. But if they lack sensibility, you are refuting them by the very fact of worshipping them with blood and steaming fat. Let any one of you endure this treatment, let him bear with these things being done to him. Nay, there is not a single man who will, if he can help it, suffer this infliction, for he has sense and reason. But the stone suffers it, for it has no feeling. You do not then by your offerings show up its sensibility. Well, I could say many other things about the fact that Christians are in bondage to gods, but if to anyone even these arguments should not seem sufficient, I think it needless to say more. Now the critique here is a critique that is rooted in passages from Jeremiah and Isaiah, the classical passages that mock idolatry, the idolatry of the ancient world, where a tree would be cut down, half of the tree would be formed into the image of a god, maybe adorned with precious metals or what have you. The other half of the tree would become fuel for fire. And it is the case, this author, I think this author seems to assume that his readers, who are pagans, and Diognetus coming out of that environment, would have understood that the images that they worshipped were actually partaking of the divine. They were not simply portals to God, or the gods. They were partaking of the divine. Just the whole way he critiques it. And that seems to be the critique of the Old Testament as well. That somehow the worshippers of these images envisaged or understood these images to actually contain the divine somehow. And it's a devastating critique. And it is a critique which basically builds from the New Testament perspective as well. It's using the Old Testament passages from Isaiah and Jeremiah that critique idolatry. But it's also building from the New Testament, which is while there are many gods and lords in the pagan world, which are idols, the product of men's technology, there is, for the Christians, one true God. And thus the warnings that you find in Holy Scripture against idolatry, beginning obviously with the Second Commandment, but also a passage like 1 John, where right at the end, almost out of nowhere in one sense, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Just as he has told them, We know the Son of God has come, hath given us an understanding. We may know him that is true. We are in him that is true, even in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God. Keep yourselves from idols. And this contrast between the true God and idols. You see it in other places. You see it, for instance, in the book of Acts, in Paul's preaching there. And in some ways, the letter to Diognetus is modeled, I think, and I'm not going to spend time on this, but I think it would be a very fruitful examination to compare Diognetus' approach to conveying Christian truth and Paul's approach in Acts 17. Because in Acts 17, also Paul critiques the idolatry. It is not the case, and again, it would take us too far afield to develop this. It is not the case when Paul says in verse 22, ye men of Athens, Acts 17, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. Certain commentators view that verse as Paul's commendation of the religiosity of the Athenians. It's anything but. And as Paul goes on to say, verse 29, we ought, inasmuch then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone, graven by art and man's device. And there is a frontal attack on idolatry in Paul's text there. Or again, in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10, which deals with this whole issue of food and idolatry. And part of the problem that Paul is dealing with there is the fact that in the ancient world, restaurants as we know them today normally were connected to temples. And the food that you would eat in that restaurant had normally been sacrificed to a pagan god. And is therefore that in some way that food contaminated. Paul's one line of Paul's response is this in 1 Corinthians 8. And again, I think this is very germane to the text we're looking at. 1 Corinthians 8, 1. Now, as touching things offered unto idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge, though, puffeth up, but charity edifieth. If any man think he knoweth anything, he knoweth nothing yet as he ought to know. But if any man love God, the same is known of him. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world. There is none other God but one. For though there be, that are called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but to us there is one, but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by him. And so again, you've got this contrast between the one true God and idols. And here, very clearly said, the idols have no true existence. They do not exist. And they are the product of human technology. And this is the dominant strain in this argument, that idolatry is irrational. It ascribes to things that we have made divinity. And especially when you offer sacrifice to these things that are insensible. Now, as I said, running through this whole thought is somehow that the God you are worshiping is in that statue, that somehow that statue is divine. Otherwise, his argument would make the argument that, you know, why are you offering things to this when in fact that statue is inanimate? It's not imbued with sense. In other words, this is completely ridiculous. But at the end of it, he does intimate that there is more going on in idolatry than simply the product of human technology. In verse 10, well, I could say many other things about the fact that Christians are not in bondage to such gods. Idolatry is not simply a harmless human activity. But it is something that brings the worshiper into bondage to these gods. And that because while the actual idol does not exist as a real being, there are nonetheless powers at work in idol worship. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul, and the issues that Paul is dealing with have to be discerned very closely in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, lest you come to the very wrong conclusion that Paul is making a contradiction. In 1 Corinthians 8, he affirms quite plainly, idols do not exist. Therefore, if somebody offers you meat that has been sacrificed to an idol, you can eat that. It's not contaminated. You need to bear in mind your brother, and that lest your freedom become a means of stumbling for your brother. But the actual basic, one of the basic questions which lies behind the problem in Corinth, which is meat sacrificed to idols contaminated by the fact that it was sacrificed to an idol? No, because the idol itself does not exist. But there's another question that Paul's dealing with in the 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, which is this. Can I, therefore, go into a pagan temple and be a participant in idol worship? Because sometimes in that world, sometimes meals were actually held in the temple as part of the larger gathering, the larger worship thing. Is that feasible then? If the idol doesn't exist, it doesn't really, it's really nothing. Is that possible? Well, Paul's response to that is an adamant no. Thus he can say there in verse 14, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. This is 1 Corinthians 10, 14. I speak as to wise men, now 15. Judge ye what I speak. Say, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we being many are one bread and one body, for we are all partakers of that one bread. Behold, Israel after the flesh, are not they which eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar? What say I then? The idol is anything, or that which is offered in sacrifice to the idol is anything? But I say, the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils, and not to God. And I would not that ye should have fellowship with devils. Ye cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. Ye cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the tables of the table of devils. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Now, this is a passage which I suspect you're familiar with in the Westminster Confession of Faith and subsequent standards that derive from that, the Savoy Declaration and the Second London Confession of Faith. 1 Corinthians 10, 16 to 17 is a key text in defending a Calvinist view of the Lord's table. That at the table, we meet with the risen Christ and by the Spirit feed on him spiritually, which I think is a proper interpretation of these verses. But that's not Paul's main intent in this text. What he's doing there is he's giving an example. Just as when you have the Lord's Supper, you are meeting with the Lord himself. There is, if you come by faith and are in Christ, and there is a spiritual participation in the Lord. Likewise, in the temple, verse 18, those who ate of the sacrifice in the temple had communion with the living God. Those are examples to prove that when you go into a pagan temple and participate in pagan worship, there are powers there. They are not the idols. The idols do not exist. Thus Paul can say, what say I then? The idols anything? Well, no, he's already argued in 1 Corinthians 8 that the idol does not exist. But there are powers behind those idols. In other words, the idols are themselves a front, a cloak or a mask for demonic powers. And I take this to be a text. And again, this is one of significant relevance in the mission field today, especially in Muslim circles. Some evangelicals arguing for a mission policy argue that, you know, one of the ways that we can help reach Muslims is actually go with them to the mosque, maybe be part of a prayer service. If I read the scriptures correctly, if I'm reading this text correctly, that's completely forbidden to a believer. So the two things then, both of them are reflected in this second Diognetus chapter 2. The one is the standard Old Testament critique of idolatry, which is reiterated in the New, that idols are a product of human technology. They do not have genuine real existence, and therefore the approach here is of all of this is a violation of who you are as a human being, because God created you with reason. And idolatry is irrational. But there's also another argument which is intimated in the letters to Diogenes, which picks up the 1 Corinthians 10 idea, which is that there is a bondage that is created by idolatry. Because you are now subjecting yourself to other powers that are at work in idol worship. So that's his response then, why they do not worship the Greek and Roman gods. It is irrational, and it brings the worshiper into bondage to the idols. The third chapter and fourth chapter deal with why the Christians are not like the Jews. This, again, I think is important to note in the sense that in the book of Acts, in Acts 17, Gallio could not tell the difference between Paul, the Christian Jew, and the other Jews. As far as he was concerned, the argument between Paul and the other Jews, that should be Acts 18, Acts 18, 12 to 16. The argument between Paul and the Jews is an argument within Judaism with which the Roman Empire, the Roman state, has no interest. If Christianity had remained a subset within Judaism, obviously in God's purposes it was to be worldwide, but if it had remained as a subset within Judaism, one dare say that the Roman persecution of the church would not have taken place. It was as Christianity moves beyond the framework of Judaism and begins to preach the gospel is preached to Gentiles, and Romans and Greeks are being won to Christ, that now if the Roman state perceives it as a threat to its existence, a challenge to its authority. And the fact in chapter three, the author can ask, why aren't you like the Jews? I think is indicative that now the church is increasingly more Gentile than Jewish. In the next place, I suppose, that you're especially anxious to hear why they, Christians, do not worship in the same manner as the Jews. The Jews, indeed, since they abstain from the religion described above, rightly deem that they worship the one God of the universe and think of him as master. But in offering this service to him, in like fashion to those already mentioned, they go utterly astray. For as the Greeks furnish an example of foolishness by making offerings to images void of sense and hearing, these Jews ought rather to consider it folly, maybe, but not piety, in thinking they are offering these things to God as though he were in need of them. For he who made the heaven and the earth and all things that are in them, a constant refrain from the scriptures, and provides us with all what we need, would not himself need any of these things which he himself supplies to those who imagine that they give to him. But those who think that they are rendering due sacrifices to him by blood and fat and whole burnt offerings, and that they are doing him reverence by these tributes, seem to me in no way better than those who show the same lavish honor to deaf images. For the one class seem to offer sacrifices to things unable to partake of the honor, the other to him who is in need of nothing. But in truth, I do not think that you need to learn from me that after all their qualms concerning food, their superstition about the Sabbath, their vaunting of circumcision, the cant of fasting and new moon are utterly absurd and unworthy of any argument. But how can it be other than unlawful to receive some of the things created by God for man's use as created good, and a few of the others as useless and superfluous? And is it not impious to slander God as though he forbids the doing of a good deed on the Sabbath day, and to glory in the mutilation of the flesh as evidence of their election, as if they are on this account especially beloved by God? Does this not call for derision? And their stargazing and watching of the moon, so as to observe months and days and distribute at their own inclinations the orderings of God and the change of the seasons, making some into feasts, others into times of mourning. Who would consider this an example of piety and not much more of folly? Well then, I think that you have learned sufficiently that Christians are right in keeping aloof from the general fatuity and deceit and from the meddlesomeness and pride of the Jews. But as for the mystery of the Christian's own religion, don't expect you to learn it, able to learn this from man. Now that again is a fascinating text, and it speaks along two lines. Number one, His argument here is that while the Jews worship God, the true God, they believe that in what they offer to God, that God is in need of these things. And thus, the various things that they offer to God, the sacrifices, but God does not need such. Now, it's interesting because by this time, there's no temple. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD. And so it's never been clear to me the way in which the author is arguing, because unless he's thinking of the Passover. But having said that, in the chapter 4, I have some concerns. On the one hand, there certainly is a recognition that Christianity, there are elements of discontinuity between the new covenant and the old covenant, that part of the old covenant had to do with God's working within the context of one particular nation and one particular place of worship and various elements of worship that went on in the temple. But it also strikes me that the author fails to understand at this point, and this becomes probably the one weakness, the major weakness of the document. He fails to understand that these things that he is describing, circumcision, for example, the various feasts, were actually prescribed by God. They are Old Testament. And they are shadows, reading the writing of Hebrews, they are shadows of the good things to come. In other words, does the author fully appreciate the way in which the New Testament is essential to the understanding of what's going on in the New? Does he understand fully the way in which the Old Testament, in various things that are discontinued, those things are shadows of what is to come? And it strikes me that he doesn't. And there is a failure to understand the relationship between the Old and New Covenants. And that these elements of the Old Testament that he mentions are very much ordinances of God, which have purpose and fulfillment in the New Covenant. So there is a concern there, and this will give him problems when he comes to answer this question, because he will not be able to fall back on the Old Testament as indicative of the fact that Christianity has been around for a lot longer than the Roman Empire has been around. And he can go back, the promise to Abraham and all of the Old Testament promise that is fulfilled in Christ indicates that there is a significant continuity. Abraham is the model of what biblical faith in God looks like, Romans 4. But he can't do that because he has indicated this disjuncture between Christianity and Judaism. Which is interesting because in chapter 2, he uses the Old Testament, very clearly uses Isaiah and Jeremiah in critiquing paganism. Now, scholars have debated the question as to why is it that the author makes the sort of radical disjuncture between Old and New Covenant here. Some scholars believe that it's the climate of the church in the late 2nd century. First of all, you've got Gnosticism. The author is not a Gnostic. There is no doubt about that. He is not a Gnostic. But you do have a climate in which the Gnostics are wanting to discard the Old Testament. Secondly, in the 130s, there was a revolt that took place under a man named Bar Kokhba. And it's the last major military attempt by the Jews to throw off the Roman yoke. The first one would be 66 to 73, the Jewish War, which ended in the taking of Jerusalem, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple. In the 130s, this man, Bar Kokhba, who was acclaimed as the Messiah by a very prominent rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, wages a fairly successful war against a number of Roman legions in Palestine, actually destroys 3 or 4 Roman legions before the Romans are able to quash the rebellion. And at that point, they expelled the Jews from Palestine completely. And it could be, and there, I think there's some evidence for this in Christian documents at the time, the church wanted to distance itself from a zealot-like Judaism or Jewish zealotry. And so it may be the fact that this author is influenced by that, this wanting to show that we are definitely not Jews, and thus he overstresses the disjuncture between Old and New Covenants. Either way, definitely this is the weakest part of the document, the failure to appreciate the nature of the relationship between Old and New, promise and fulfillment, and also the whole idea of significant elements of continuity. The Sabbath, for example, is not discarded in the New. It is repositioned in terms of the Lord's Day, but it's not discarded. So there are elements of significant continuity which this author fails to appreciate. Now, in chapter 5 and chapter 6, he deals with this issue. Not so much who is God, but why do they disdain the world? And the fact that the church is countercultural. And there's a couple of things in here I think that are particularly fine in terms of the way of describing the church. I'm going to read chapter 5. Chapter 6 I'll leave you to read later, in which he compares the church to the church's relationship to the world. The church is to the world as the soul is to the body. Chapter 5. For Christians are distinguished. Notice, by the way, at the end of chapter 4, he indicates that Christianity is not a product of human thinking. It is revelation. Do not expect to be able to learn the mystery of Christianity from man. And it's revelation, and God must teach us about his truth. For Christians are distinguished, this is now chapter 5, for Christians are distinguished from the rest of men, neither by country, nor by language, nor by customs, for nowhere do they dwell in cities of their own. They do not use any strange form of speech or practice a singular mode of life. This lore of theirs, or this teaching of theirs, has not been discovered by any design and thought of prying men, nor do they champion a mere human doctrine, as some men do. But while they dwell in both Greek and barbarian cities, each as his lot was cast, and follow the customs of the land in dress and food and other matters of living, they show forth the remarkable and admittedly strange order of their own citizenship. They live in fatherlands of their own, but as aliens. They share all things as citizens and suffer all things as strangers. Every foreign land is their fatherland, and every fatherland a foreign land. They marry, like all others. They breed children. Probably a better word there to translate that would be they bear children. They bear children, but they do not cast out their offspring. Free board they provide, but no carnal bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they have their citizenship in heaven. They obey the appointed laws, yet in their own lives they excel the laws. They love all men, are persecuted by all. They are known, yet they are condemned. They are put to death, yet they are made alive. They are poor, yet they make many rich. They suffer the lack of all things, yet they abound in all things. They are dishonored, and yet are glorified in their dishonor. They are ill spoken of, yet are vindicated. They are reviled, and they bless. Insulted, they repay with honor. When doing good, they are punished as evildoers. Suffering punishment, their rejoices have quickened into life. By the Jews, they are warred against as foreigners, and are hunted down by the Greeks. Yet those who hate them cannot state the cause of their hostility. Now, before I get into the way in which he argues for Christians being in the world but not of the world, notice he does emphasize, and this will come up again, that Christianity is not learned from men. Verse 3, one cannot discover this by human ingenuity. It is not a mere human doctrine. Now, early Christianity, then, does not distinguish itself from the rest of mankind by the fact that they lived in a separate country. This is in quite strong contrast to Judaism. The Jews had a homeland, which was within the Roman Empire, but not so Greek Christians. Christians didn't have their own language. There wasn't a particular language that the Christians spoke. Some both spoke Greek as their mother tongue, others Latin, others Aramaic or Hebrew or Syriac or Gaulish or what have you. Their customs are not different. And he's speaking here very generally. He will indicate in a minute that they do have differences. They follow the customs of the land in which they live in dress and food. But nonetheless, they have another citizenship. They live in fatherlands of their own, but as aliens. In other words, he now picks up one of the great themes of the New Testament, which is that we are aliens and strangers. We are pilgrims. This is not our home. And while we have a loyalty, there is an element, there's a level of loyalty to the nation in which we find ourselves born. Nonetheless, there is a higher loyalty that if those two loyalties conflict, we are called upon to be subject to that higher loyalty, the fact that we are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And so they lived, and the Romans, by the way, it's interesting how different peoples view their homeland. The Romans always called the Roman Empire the fatherland. Similar to Nazi Germany, dissimilar, for instance, to Communist Russia. Communist Russia always called their homeland the motherland. And I'm not sure whether what kind of thinking drives that. But anyway, the Romans always talked about their state as the fatherland. What are they they live in a fatherland. Yes, they are Romans. But on the one hand, they are Romans. On the other hand, though, they are aliens and strangers. And here the author then is raising one of the critical Christian questions about the relationship of Christ, commitment to Christ, and culture. And there is a classic text written by Richard Niebuhr. H. Richard Niebuhr. He's not an evangelical. He's one of the two Niebuhr brothers who are both neo-Orthodox. But it's a classic study which is frequently referenced called Christ and Culture, in which he distinguishes five different approaches to culture that the church has adopted down through the years. Among some of the early Christians, I don't think this author has this view, but I think some of the early Christians do, like Tertullian, when he asks the question, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem? It's a rhetorical question. And his answer is nothing. And Tertullian has a very much a Christ against culture perspective, which I think has typified certain sectors of Christianity down through the years. Anabaptists, and I'm a Baptist, but I don't see the Anabaptists as my forebears in any way, shape, or form. I think the Mennonites and Hutterites have classically been Christ against culture. Certain streams of fundamentalism have been Christ against culture. I think the biblical model is Christ the transformer of culture, which is one that Niebuhr mentions in that particular book. But that's the issue that he's wrestling with is, how as a Christian do I relate to my culture? And without a shadow of a doubt, the early church found herself in a situation in which they were identical to their culture in a number of areas. Their clothing, to some degree. Language, customs, food. But there were areas in which they said an emphatic no to their culture. And he mentions two here in particular. By the way, I think you also hear here in this text a preacher. The way he structures it, it's got a preaching sound to it. And it could very well be that the author is an early Christian preacher as well. The two areas in which he gives an emphatic no is verse 6, is in the whole area of sexuality. They marry like all others. They bear children. In other words, the idea of celibacy, which comes into the life of the church as a requirement for those in vocational ministry, is completely unheard of in this period. That is actually not till after the fall of the Roman Empire. They marry, they have children, But, well, sorry, the first one he deals with, sorry, is the relationship of family, and then sexuality. They marry, they have children, but they do not cast out their offspring. In the ancient world, there's a great little book called Abortion, a great little study of abortion in the early church, and the author's name is a man named Michael Gorman. And I forget the exact title. I think it's Abortion in the Early Church, and or Abortion and the Early Church probably is the title, by Michael Gorman, who taught for a while at Hillsdale College here in Michigan. And the book provides clear evidence that abortion was something that was done in antiquity. However, because of the nature of the technology at that time, it frequently issued in the death of the mother, and thus was not the normal way of pagans dealing with children they didn't want. Normally, then, they allowed the mother would go full term, and the baby be delivered, and then it would be cast out. And the Greek word is ekbalo. And we have a document, probably about 100 years prior to this. A father is away from home in Alexandria. His home is in Alexandria. This was found among the Oxyrhynchi, the papyri Oxyrhynchi. And the papyri Oxyrhynchi are basically documents found in the rubbish heap of Alexandria. And I remember reading on one occasion that enough documents were found from this rubbish heap and are now in the British Museum, in the basement of the British Museum, that if you had a team of five or six scholars, it would keep them busy. If they worked 5 days a week, 48, 50 weeks a year, it would keep them busy for the next 400 years. Is transcribing them. That's how much stuff is being brought out. And one of them that was published in the, I think it was the early 20th century, it might have been later, but I think it was the early 20th century, is a document of a little letter written by a father to his expectant wife. And he says bluntly, if it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, ekbala, cast it out. And this was the way the Roman world dealt, the Greco-Roman world dealt with unwanted children. It could be the case that the family was wealthy and they didn't want another mouth. They didn't want another person to divide up the inheritance. The father wanted as many as he wanted only so many children, so the inheritance, so each of the children would have the lifestyle that he had enjoyed. Or it could be that the family is poor and they couldn't afford another mouth to feed. Or it could be the father didn't believe that the child was his. There was a Roman ceremony. The Greeks did not do this, but the Romans did. That when a child was born, it was brought and laid at the feet of the father. If the father reached down and picked the child up, then he was accepting in the household. If not, the child was to be cast out. And so any number of reasons why sinful men and women would want to choose to cast a child out. The child would sometimes be put in the street or more often placed on the edge of town at the garbage dumps, and where the child would either die from exposure, be eaten by one of the packs of semi-wild dogs that kind of were part of ancient cities, the world of the ancient cities. Dogs were not normally kept as pets, quite strong contrast today. And or they would be picked up by slave traders, sold as slaves, or if they were girls, raised as prostitutes. The church made a point of going strongly against that whole perspective. And it was part of a general worldview that is biblical, obviously, a general worldview that views the value of each human life and would regard such as murder. And the early church stood against this. It was part of a larger platform, as it were. Stood against the gladiatorial games, which there were actually very foundational to Roman life. I'll talk about them in a minute. and also stood against most of the early Christians in this period are between 100 and 300 are pacifists and refuse to participate in the army. And partly because of the nature of the Roman army, partly of the idolatry that was rampant in the Roman army, but also because of the what they saw as the rapacious bloodshed that was committed by the Roman army. And so here is a very clear indication that the church, well, I think that by and large the church in this period was not flawless. And given the nature of life in this world, it is never the case that a Christian community is going to be flawless. But they were able to achieve a significant degree of separation from the world that clearly marked them as different. And I think is an essential mark of the church, that we are to be different from the world, our culture. I don't believe it's a Christ against culture model. I think we are to live in the world in such a way that culture is transformed as we witness and as we do the vocations God has called us to. But nonetheless, there must be a difference between the church and the world. And our great challenge today, I think, in the broader streams of evangelicalism, is we live in a larger Christian culture that in many respects wants to get as close to the world as possible without getting burned. And I think the early church is a model here. The second area is sexuality. And the author says, free board they provide. That's a great theme of early Christianity, hospitality. 1 Timothy chapter 3, what must an elder be? He must be hospitable. Part of that goes back to the fact that elders must be lovers of people. They must love people. But also they must be people who open their homes. There are, again, some concrete reasons for that. When you are traveling from one area to another, and the inns and motels the inns in the Roman world were renowned for immorality, or often associated with the occult, for whatever reason. And so discerning travelers usually stayed with relatives, or they stayed with business acquaintances. In the church, if you're going to an area where you had neither relatives nor business acquaintances, your first question to ask would be, who are the elders in the church there? Where do they live? And the elder would expect, therefore, people visiting who are coming to the area, and he'd have to at least put them up for one night till they could somebody else could be found who might take them for a longer stay. And so the elders have to be committed to hospitality. Third John, that's what Third John is all about, hospitality. First Peter 4, be hospitable without grumbling. Hebrews 13, verse 2, you are to entertain strangers. For some have entertained or practiced hospitality, for some have entertained strangers unawares. Or rather, some have entertained angels unawares. And so hospitality is a very critical theme in New Testament thinking. And that's what this author is reflecting. Christians are hospitable, but again, there are limits. They do not provide a carnal bed. And sexual immorality, I mean, our culture is rapidly moving down that road and removing restraints that a Christian foundation had placed upon this whole area. But we're still nowhere near as bad as the Roman world, where prior to the advent of Christianity, there had been, apart from common grace, there had been no light. And homosexuality was rampant in this world, and sexual immorality. And the early church, again, it's a very strong, emphatic no against that. And again, this is an area in which we need to be distinguished. And it's very disturbing to see trends in the larger North American evangelical scene in the last probably 20, 25 years.